This is Jazz Talk, presented by Melbourne International Jazz Festival. We would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land and pay respects to their elders past, present and future, as well to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people in the wider Melbourne community and beyond. We are honoured to contribute to over 60,000 years of music making, knowledge sharing and storytelling that has taken place on this land. I'm Chelsea Wilson, Artistic Associate of Melbourne International Jazz Festival Congress. This session was recorded at Melbourne Recital Centre as part of the 2021 Jazz Festival Congress with multi-award-winning composer, pianist and Melbourne International Jazz Festival Artist-in-Residence Paul Grabowski AO. Since the 1970s, Paul Grabowski has built a commanding international reputation, working in Europe and the US, performing alongside jazz icons Chet Baker, Art Farmer and Johnny Griffin. On home soil, he firmly established himself as one of Australia's leading jazz musicians and composers with his own trio and sextet, and as musical director for Tonight Live with Steve Izard. This conversation is hosted by his friend and longtime collaborator, Steve Izard. This is Paul Grabowski in conversation.
Thank you. Well, thanks for coming, guys. No, please keep it down. And thanks for coming. So it's pretty early on a Saturday morning, and particularly during the festival when people are seeing things happen. So for those of you who come along, thank you. I think the thing here is we'll treat it exactly like you and I, Paul, would treat a Saturday morning coffee, which is exactly like it is.
What we're doing.
Keep this very informal.
Yeah.
And to the point where, what do you think, if given that there's a relatively small number of people, if anyone's got any questions or things that they might want to ask...
Of course.
Perhaps they could drop round to your house after the thing and you could offer them dinner. If anyone's got any questions or things...
Well, they can help you with the irrigating.
Or with my irrigation, which I've driven up from. So I think we might do that. If anyone wants to hear anything specifically that we haven't covered, which is almost certainly going to be the case...
Speak up.
I might every so often just ask if anyone's got a question on any topic. Mm. And we don't even need microphones particularly because literally... we'll be able to hear very clearly. So, good to see you, mate.
Here we are, mate.
How's COVID been for you?
It's been a strange couple of years, I think. I think for the whole industry, it's been a time of crisis.
Yeah.
I mean, the performing arts, as you know, are a kind of fairly fragile ecosystem at the best of times, and very much postulated on the whole idea of people being available to come and see shows and shows being allowed to be performed.
The idea of a performer and an audience.
And both of those particular ingredients were removed from the equation. So there was effectively a complete shutdown globally, not just in Australia. And that's never really happened, I think, ever, possibly in the history of civilization at all, that all performances have ceased.
So how did you keep yourself busy creatively?
Well, look, I was very fortunate in a number of ways, actually, Steve. I had the opportunity to write music for the Melbourne Symphony Orchestra. I was asked to become their composer in residence before this whole business started. So that was in 2019, the offer was made. And that was going to be being effectively the composer in residence for the year 2020. And when it became apparent that whatever plans they had made for 2020 weren't going to happen, it was pushed into 21, and now it's been pushed into 22.
So you could string this out to the end of the decade. That's your objective.
It'll be the longest residency in the history of the MSO.
What have you been doing with them particularly?
So I wrote one large piece, which is the sort of culmination of a relationship that I've enjoyed for nearly 20 years now with some traditional musicians from Southeast Arnhem Land, from Nooka, which I know is a place that quite coincidentally your family have an association with. And as you know, I started working with them basically testing the proposition around is it possible to collaborate, find common ground between contemporary jazz improvisation or contemporary improvisation in general and the musical practices of our First Nations people from that part of the world who have a musical form called manake, which is very, very sophisticated. And being a complete rookie in this area, I had no sense of, you know, what I would or would not be allowed to do, whether it was even appropriate to ask such a question. But I found, much to my surprise and delight, that not only was there a willingness to explore this, but it opened up a whole world of understanding of what manake is really all about, which taught me a lot about First Nations Australians and what we could have, should have, and didn't learn from them from the moment of first contact. I mean, we could have benefited greatly from the knowledge that they were all too happy to share. But of course, coming with a very colonialist mindset, we did not take advantage of that at all.
Just want to just divert slightly, pick that up slightly on the matter of manake. I want to talk to you about what jazz is in a second.
Yeah,
because that you'll be able to answer that in a second in a sentence. But manake, if you think about what their instrumentation is, and what constitutes their music? What, if you could briefly describe what is manake and what it is you were working with?
Manake is essentially a song cycle, and manake can speak of many different things. Some people might think that these traditional modes of music making are some kind of fossilised, ritualised thing which essentially doesn't change from performance to performance. It's always rehearsing the same material. But manake is not like that at all. Manake can embrace any kind of experience, story, sing about a person or a place. And the stories and things that they refer to change, of course, from place to place, depending on who's singing the songs. There are traditional, and there are indeed taboo ceremonies and songs associated with them that I would not have access to.
Are there forms, rhythmic forms so that are used to convey these varying stories?
Yeah, the form of a manake basically goes like this. There is a sudden burst of activity, which consists of a sung line, which can be either sung by one or numerous people. And if numerous people are singing that line, then they're all singing basically the same melody, except they're giving, each person's giving their own slight variant of it. Mm-hmm. And that sense of a unison, which is like a series of slightly different unisons happening at the same time, there's a word for that in Western music theory, which is homophony. And then that sits on top of what we call the didgeridoo, but they call the yidaki. And what the yidaki plays is a complementary rhythmic structure made up of at least two different pitches. One of them is the fundamental of the instrument, which is of course a hollowed out tree log. So it's got an actual pitch that it makes. But it also makes a series of harmonics through a particular blowing technique.
Like when James Morrison elicits those
several
notes. Yes, that's
exactly right. Yeah. It's the harmonic series.
Yeah.
So what I've learned about the yidaki, and at least in terms of the way that it's performed in manake, is that the yidaki is a drum. It's a drum played with the mouth.
Yeah.
And the low and the high pitches are very comparable to a double-ended drum, like in South Indian music, there's a mridangam, which has a low pitch and a high pitch, which is like two tabla, which are basically joined together. So this idea of a low drum and a high drum, that's really what the yidaki is.
Mm-hmm.
And people talk about the didgeridoo being a drone instrument, and it is possible to play it like that, but that is certainly not its function at all. In this traditional music, it is certainly a rhythmic drumming kind of concept.
Yeah.
So that happens. It's really kind of extremely intense and quite short, and normally accompanies a dance move in which...
This is where you came in.
This is where I shine, of course. Yeah. I'm a known First Nations dancer.
Yeah.
Yeah. Greatly respected. But I'm not going to demonstrate it now because I'm not allowed to.
No, sacred.
Yeah. But the dancers move very quickly towards the onlookers. So they come at you. And then, you know,
so it's about garnering your attention. It's about a burst of
there's a gesture,
being present.
And there's an actual choreography. And, you know, the dance relates to whatever is being said in the song.
Mm.
And then at the end of this thing, it might only last for like 15, 20 seconds. There's a cadence.
Mm.
And, you know, where the yidaki and the singers kind of converge on this point. And then there's this beautiful trail off vocally. All these different sections have got terms too. There's an actual word for all the different sections in their language. And then after the end of that, there is silence. There's an absence. Or people just get about what they were doing, having a conversation, having a cigarette, you know, having a cup of tea, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And then at some point, it starts up again. So it's this stop-start thing. It is an amazing form in itself because the activity which takes place and the absence of activity are both really important factors in this. I mean, that's the sort of binary which is being proposed by Manakay, that there is this thing that happens which is so intense that it completely takes you away. It occupies you, consumes you.
Yeah, I mean, the other interesting thing about that is that it might be an absence of music, but it's not nothing per se, because it's actually getting about with normal life. And I guess that's the other point too, that the music and culture and art are intimately bound with life, with living.
And that's the whole message of Manakay. You know, when I started working with these guys, of course, you don't know as a Ballander, as a white person, coming into communities, how seriously are you going to be taken? Are they going to see you as just yet another white fella who's going to try and tell you what to do, you know, with a sort of cultural paradigm that they're going to try and overlay onto something which is, you know, your business?
Yeah.
Or is there going to be some real benefit?
Did you arrive in your private chopper?
I arrived on a barge, actually, going up a river. It was an amazing first experience.
But they've seen it. But in a way, that starting point that you've rightly described of here we go again is rightly so.
Absolutely. And what I found is that, you know, Manakay is a kind of model of the universe. And if you get permission to be part of a Manakay, then everything that you bring to that Manakay becomes the Manakay.
Mm.
And all of the responsibilities that go with that accrue, you know. You share responsibility for the very sacred act of being able to perform that material. For them, when the music is being performed, ancestors are present, you know, it's a safe space, and they are, in particular song cycles that we've been dealing with, singing about the creation of the world, the naming of things, an ancestor figure called Jawoopera, who you know, takes various different forms during the songs. And just Jawoopera, you know, he is in a sense all aspects of the universe. I mean, you and I have looked at, you know, as things to do with particle physics and you know, dark matter and things like that. In Manakay, everything is relational.
Yeah.
So, and this is really the point of, in First Nations thinking, that all things in creation, everything that we know, is only significant in its relationship to something else.
Yeah.
And, you know, we know from the most arcane explorations of particle physics that some people maintain is the structure of dark matter is relational.
It's all relational.
It's relational. So. It's vibrational and relational.
I want to This whole discussion and you doing that, thinking about that, listening to that, it's a long way from a young man growing up in suburban Melbourne listening to Music to Midnight, was it?
It was. Well, that famous program, which you reminded me, started with Arch McCurdy.
Arch McCurdy.
I picked it up during the Ian Neild period,
yep,
into Ralph Rickman,
yep,
and then got on to Jim McLeod when Jim started to broadcast on the FM network.
If you're not aware of it, this was a radio program that the ABC used to broadcast. But it started at 10 o'clock on every night. Every
Monday
weeknight,
to Friday.
Monday to Friday. They'd have a Music to Midnight. Started at 10, ended at midnight. And I guess it was national, wasn't it? And
it was national.
And it was just literally playing jazz. I started listening when it was Arch McCurdy,
wow.
I think.
Yeah.
And his version of it was probably now more middle of the road. It was Cleo Lane and John Dankworth.
Well, that's sort of what Ian Neild played too. I would describe what he played as mainstream jazz. You know, and I learned to identify, because I was such a, you know, I had a very good ear for music.
Really?
Well, yeah, strange about that.
You should get into it. You should pursue that. Really.
It sounds like the most ridiculous thing in the world to say now. But I had a very good musical memory, and I learned quite early on through listening to that program to be able to recognise certain people through the way they played, having heard them a few times. So people like Oscar Peterson, for example, who you got to hear a lot on the
show. Or Dave Brubeck, they played a lot.
Dave Brubeck, the modern jazz quartet.
Yeah.
You know, or Australian musicians like Don Burrows, you know, used to get played.
They played Don Burrows a lot.
Yeah.
And George Gollar.
Yeah. You know, Judy Bailey.
Yeah.
You know, so these were all names that got introduced to me when I was a teenager, a young teenager.
Yeah.
And that was my favourite thing. I'd do my homework and then I'd go to bed and listen to Music to Midnight.
Would you have a transistor, would you?
Yeah.
Under the pillow. I did too.
Yeah. I had a little radio beside the bed and that was the world that I inhabited.
Yeah.
I loved it.
And so that was your earliest encounter with jazz?
Well, not my earliest, actually. The earliest encounter I had with jazz must have been when I was pre-verbal, because according to my mother, the first thing I ever said, and this was when I was close to 2 years old. So for the first couple of years, they thought, what have I got here? You know, because I didn't really say anything.
Yeah.
We were down at Point Leo,
yeah,
and on a family holiday. And, you know, remember they used to have tannoys outside the surf lifesaving club. And they'd be playing...
Stay between the flags and...
playing the radio.
Yeah, but and then they'd say someone's drowning occasionally.
That's right. All of a sudden, I blurted out, take five. Because take five was playing on the tannoys. Because it was a pop hit, you know.
It was.
It's actually got radio play in 1960.
Yeah.
So, you know, that was great for my parents.
Take five.
So he can say at least two words and relates to that piece of music. How the hell does he know that it's called Take Five? But apparently what I'd been doing, you know, is listening. So my gathering of information, the beginning of my accrual of any kind of knowledge about the world was basically done through my ears, my eyes. And then when I had something to say, I said it. And the next thing I said after take five was Craven A Filter, Michael.
Right.
Because I'd noticed that my brother smoked Craven A Filters.
What a dibber-dobber.
So I think, you know, jazz, smoking, you know, I was on the pathway.
Yeah, fantastic. Mm. And so you then went to, we'll quickly get through Paul's This Is Your Life phase, but you went to uni, you got into the Connaught Melbourne uni.
Yep, which is when I met you, actually.
Met you. Neither of us doing any study whatsoever.
Mm. We must have met at Norton's, did we?
We met at Norton's at the pub.
No.
That's regularly.
That's the only place we met. That's the only place.
Well, you never went to any lectures.
Not that I recall.
The only thing I remember about you is that is that they saved up an enormous amount of money to acquire a new Steinway.
Yeah.
and the dean of the faculty was waiting for some occasion to launch this with some classical performance, and it was had been on the stage and it had arrived by container and had been brought into the hall and positioned there, and it was in readiness for this launch. And he walked in one lunchtime or something to find you playing jazz on his precious piano before it had been christened, and all hell broke loose, as I recall.
Yeah, he came and he stormed into Melbourne Hall and said, no jazz will be played on this instrument. That was Max Cook.
Yeah, no, I remember that because the only reason I remember that is because you came over the pub and downloaded all the information. You'd just been abused by the dean. And I think that was pretty much the end of your academic career at Melbourne University.
You know, funnily enough, it was almost. I mean, my first year at the Con, I did very well. And I was still kind of, you know, with my wonderful teacher, Mac Yost, and, you know, still very, very much involved in classical music and practising a lot. And I did a very, you know, ambitious final recital for my first year recital.
What did you do?
I did the Alban Berg Sonata and I did the Schumann Papillon and I think I did a Bach Suite, maybe. Mm. But look, it was grown-ups music, you know, for sure.
Yeah.
And but, you know, as I got more and more into jazz, I got less and less interested in continuing to play classical music. And in those days, there was nowhere to study jazz in Melbourne.
No.
So by the end of second year, you know, we'd started doing the Hardy Perennials. We'd started doing reviews.
We were doing shows. We worked out we could get paid money if we went around to country pubs and any pub and did these shows. And we'd get paid a fortune.
It was great. It was great. We had a sort of university review, basically, it was. And, yeah, we did a lot of rural Victorian gigs, and it was fantastic. And, you know, that took us all into that sort of theatre restaurant world, and which I learned an awful lot of, you know, very useful information musically from doing that, because I got to work with a lot of music theatre style, sort of Broadway style singers, which, you know, that repertoire, very important.
A lot of those were standards.
They
too.
Were.
So let's now move into the area of jazz, which, you know, on account of the fact that is the topic. So what, you take a standard, you take a piece of music, and I know this is the big perennial question, but I'm interested in your take on it. What makes that jazz?
Well, it depends, you know, what makes a piece jazz is the way you play it. And it's a big question. It's the perennial question around jazz. What is jazz?
Yeah,
you know, and it's
talk about it till the cows come home. But you can never talk about it enough.
Well, you'd never arrive at a point that everybody would agree, I think. I mean, jazz.
What's your thinking at the moment?
Well, I've always thought a couple of things about jazz. I always say to people, jazz for most people will be what they first encountered when they associated a piece of music with the word jazz. And depending on what it is that you've heard, it might be, you know, Chuck Mangione or Al Jarreau
or Don Burrows or whatever.
Kenny G, you know, perish the thought, but nevertheless, a lot of people would regard that as being jazz because they
or
have
Louis
no
Armstrong
reason.
Or Louis Armstrong or...
Of course, Louis Armstrong. I mean, if you have not disabused of the notion that something is jazz, then you're quite allowed and you know, forgiven for thinking that something is
But that still
jazz.
Doesn't get you there. That might be one condition of it.
That's right.
But because you could first hear Holst.
That's more by way of describing what an incredibly broad and rather amorphous mass of music comes
so
under the
big.
Word jazz.
Yeah.
But jazz has always for me been a process. So if you look at the way that jazz arrived in the first place, jazz grew in the first instance out of the experience of being enslaved African Americans and having transplanted an African way of making music to this place that none of them had ever intended to end up, where they were then exposed to a whole host of other cultural influences. So particularly in a place like New Orleans, it was because of the peculiarities of the culture of New Orleans, which for a while in the 19th century had a more, I guess, racially fluid and liberal kind of social world, where as a person of colour it was possible for you to, you know, have some kind of social mobility, and where there was a Francophone and sort of European continental aspirational culture, which I think introduced a sort of musical vocabulary into the world in general in that place. And then there was, you know, the blues, and that the blues was a kind of a spiritual response to the pain of slavery and the work associated with it. Then there was the influence of the church and the strange kind of fusion of Christianity as a aspirational world with the reality of slavery. And what arose out of that was the African-American response to Christian music, which was, you know, in the black church, spirituals and gospel music. And that's very related to the blues. And the way those songs are sung relates very closely to the blues. Then you had instruments which came into the hands of people after the American Civil War, a lot of brass instruments and so on. And out of all of this, over time, various kinds of music took root. And at some point, and this all predated the recording of music, the great irony, of course, is that the first actual recording of jazz, which is by the original New Orleans Dixieland band, was only jazz band, was an all-white band, 1917. Livery Stable Blues. And
just on that topic, do you think that sort of, you know, the idea of a lament and a you know, an absolute yearning for freedom and a yearning to be free, as a touchstone for, as a source of music and as a subject matter of the music, actually also became present in the freedom within the music to experiment, improvise? The very idea of freedom as a goal becomes freedom as expression.
I think that's absolutely central to the whole history of jazz.
On that topic, do you see, or are you conscious of that in your search, not conscious, not deliberate search, but in the way you've gathered up your own version of what it is to play jazz in Australia, working with First Nations people here? Do you see that as some kind of direct extension, conscious or otherwise?
Look, I've had the opportunity to work with First Nations people across now a whole raft of different First Nations experiences. And whether it's been the work with Archie Roach and the late Ruby Hunter, which is more dealing with the experience of the stolen generation, or the concert that I'll be doing on this very stage tonight with Emma Donovan, which is looking at hymns and spiritual songs that she grew up singing in communities. These are three different kinds of experience that, you know, Archie and Ruby wrote songs about their lives.
There's a lot of stolen generation material.
Yeah, and, you know, famous songs like They Took the Children Away, you know, really have become quite iconic songs. And you know, there's a pain and a sense of loss, but also a sense of redemption and forgiveness in all of that material. I mean, Archie, you know, some of the earlier work is full of anger and this real pain and loss. But as he got older, there's a feeling of hope and definitely of forgiveness and of what we should regard as the important things in life. With Emma's stuff, it's really, you know, very raw, because a lot of these songs that we're singing tonight are associated with funerals in community. So for her to have chosen this material is a very big statement from her, I think.
These songs were the equivalent of the sort of the spirituals for so many of the Indigenous people who grew up in church communities.
That's right.
Who were themselves many stolen generation, but
that's right.
These were the songs they grew up with, their versions of spirituals. They were basically Church of England songs, weren't they?
Yeah, a lot of them were. Yeah.
Well, just on that, should we just get Paul to play something just to break up the dialogue? Are you playing any? What are you playing tonight?
Oh, we're playing the song that the actual show is called "The Old Rugged Cross," which is an old hymn. A lot of these songs are also associated with country music. People like Johnny Cash and the Carter family, and you know, they all sang these things.
Can you just on this? Can you just play the basic melody and then just talk us through how you've approached your version of this song and how you've reached what? I mean, I know you're going to do it tonight, but just talk us through the basic melody and then.
Well, here's the basic melody.
Sort of Tammy Wynette, Johnny Cash.
Yeah, it's a beautiful song.
Beautiful song. So, how do you begin to approach that song?
Well, the first thing is I wanted to, you know, really give these songs a kind of traditional jazz feeling. So I've written for a front line, which is a typical kind of Dixieland front line of trumpet, trombone and saxophone, but he also plays clarinet. In some songs. And I've arranged the music in such a way that it would, if a Dixieland band was playing that song, it's the sort of way they would play it. So, the harmonies would be not that dissimilar from what I just played. I mean, the thing with these changes is once you get into the improvising, any kind of jazz musician from a traditional player to a modern player would find different things to do with them. They're very strong harmonic structures. Thank you.
Nice.
You know, so yeah. All very strong material. And a couple of the songs that we're doing were written by Emma's grandfather, who was a preacher.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
So just about obligation, I want to talk to you about respect and obligation, which is important in the way you play. How much obligation do you feel to yourself to treat a standard, a tune like that, with your own way, but also how much respect and obligation to the existing tune not to completely deconstruct it so that it's something else? What's the balance in that?
Well, you know, when you're working with a singer, particularly a great singer like Emma, the really important thing is, in the first instance, to make her feel very supported. Because I know how emotionally raw it is for her to sing these songs. So you don't want to place these songs into such a kind of alienated context that all it's doing is forcing her to go, I don't even understand what you've done with this.
Yeah. She's got to feel comfortable.
Yeah, and in fact, not just comfortable, I think you've got to set it up so that it's absolutely creating a platform for her to just do exactly whatever she feels.
Right.
And so the idea of being in support is the first thing to always bear in mind. Then you've got to think about, well, you know, I've got all these great players. How can I make best use of them? And in this particular instance, I've got people like Mirko, who can play a number of different instruments, including these really extraordinary folk instruments from Italy. So in one song, I've got him playing a shepherd's type of pipe thing from, well, it's called a duruk, actually, and it's I think that one, that particular instrument is Turkish. But you've... Yeah, that's it. That's a duruk.
I've never seen that before.
Right. Yeah.
What does it look like? What is it? I didn't.
It's a wooden double reed instrument.
Yep. Like an oboe or something.
Yeah, but like a really a folk version of that.
Yep.
And it makes this very haunting sound. And, you know, it's a sound that you would associate with a shepherd.
Yeah.
Or a goat herd out on the hills of, you know, Anatolia or, Sardinia or somewhere like that. Really plaintive and beautiful sound. So, you know, there's the opportunity when you're working with musicians like that to really create a world of colour and dynamics and orchestral kinds of sounds that, again, lift the music and take it somewhere else. But not that far that it's going to be making the singer think, wait a minute.
What the hell?
Come
what
back,
is this?
Come back. You know, you're leaving me behind here. That's basically that's the challenge, but it's also the opportunity with dealing with that sort of music. Now, on the other side of the equation, I've dealt with, other standard material, like one of the projects I did, which was a foundational project for the Australian Art Orchestra 25 years ago, or 30 years ago, was Ringing the Bell Backwards. And in that, I dealt with European popular songs of the 1930s and 40s. But because there was nobody singing the songs, I could really afford to effectively deconstruct them or place them in very unusual sonic contexts or use the music as a way on creating a commentary around, you know, the ironies associated with the songs and where they arose, particularly a couple of the German songs from that period. And, making a kind of a political statement with them. And again, you know, working with great musicians, but you can afford to be more gloves off in a situation like that. You don't have to, you know, carefully tiptoe around the original material in the fear of offending somebody or of, you know, a singer not knowing anymore where they fit into something. It's much more free range in that regard.
I'm going to ask if anyone's got any sort of comments or questions I want to ask, but before I do that, I'm interested in if jazz is indeed, as you say, this viral thing that spreads and slightly mutates, so people have got their own it's probably completely the wrong analogy at this time, but so that we have Brazilian versions of this, and you know, and each is valid and true in its own way. Why is it that when we think of jazz standards, we don't have the equivalent sort of addition to the great songbook? We always go back to the great American songbook. Why is it that the canon of jazz is still the American canon of jazz when we look at standards? And if what you're saying is right, we should have seen this proliferation of versions of that elsewhere. How does that happen?
Well, look, I think whilst what you're saying certainly holds true for most of the music recorded up until, let's say, the year 2000, for want of a... It's a fairly random selection, but anyway. I think the generation of, you know, millennials and post-millennials who are playing what they regard as jazz are definitely as interested in more recently written popular music than they are of, you know, the great canon of Cole Porter and Rodgers and Hammerstein and Jerome Kern and Hoagy Carmichael. Mm-hmm. I mean, for you and I, that was our bread and butter. Mm. And I still think that, you know, in American jazz education, most students would be very familiar with, you know, the standard repertoire.
Yeah.
Because it's part of the American attachment to an art form, which after all is an American art form in its first instance, and indeed I would argue strongly that it's an African-American art form, that whatever has been part of that tradition, in the same way that classical musicians study Bach and Beethoven, that, you know, you learn the standard repertoire. And the reason why we learn those songs is because they've got incredible structures, they've got beautiful melodies, they've got amazing lyrics. You know, I was just thinking about a song that I will play at the end of this, which is Every Time We Say Goodbye.
It's a beautiful song.
Yeah, beautiful song and beautiful words.
Yeah.
You know, every time we say goodbye,
I die a little.
Every time we say goodbye, I wonder why a little.
Why a little?
Why but also, the gods above us?
The addition of I wonder why a little, just changing the structure of.
I wonder why a little, and then he develops that thought. Why the gods above us, who must be in the know, or why the gods above me, who must be in the know, think so little of me, they allow you to go.
Yeah.
You know, what a wonderful stanza.
Great lyrics.
And then when you're near, there's such an air of spring. Around
about me.
Me is
about.
I can hear somewhere.
You can watch this for hours while we try and work out the lyrics here. Spring about me.
I can hear a lark somewhere begin to sing about it.
Sing about.
There's no love song finer. But how strange.
This is the best
how
line.
Strange the change from major to minor. Every time
that
we
is
say
such
goodbye.
A great line.
Yeah.
And so beautifully.
So why wouldn't you want to play or sing a song like that? You know, there's so much material
how
in there to work
the
with.
Strange the change from major to minor. What? That is just genius, isn't it?
But I love playing, you know, Lennon and McCartney songs. I mean, I've played Burt Bacharach songs and recorded them in my career.
Well, take your collaboration with Paul Kelly.
Yeah.
Some people would say that the songs, if you do look at them, they're beautifully delivered, they're deeply felt, great lyrics. But some people would say, if you're looking at them from a distance, that they're not complex musically. That would be their starting point. So you come to it. Where do you start with, say, his repertoire?
Well, with Paul's songs, you know, again, you've got to be very careful not to take Paul away from the Paulness of being Paul. there is a certain way that he sings his material, which is absolutely the way it has to be. He's got a very strong sense of himself and a very strong sense of his relationship to what he writes. And depending on what the song is, I'll either, you know, create a pianistic version of it, or I'll be very reliant on what the original sounded like in order to build my part around that. A song like If I Could Start Today Again, for example, you wouldn't want to mess too much with that song. I mean, it's so kind of perfect in and of itself that all I try to do with that is convey the sense of it without trying to get too fancy or change chords or anything like that. With some of the other songs, I might really make a very simple chord change here or there, but it would be no more or less than, you know, going from basically a tonic major chord and maybe to a relative minor chord to give it a slightly sadder, you know, more somber feeling if the song called for it. But again, you know, that's the song we played, the one song that I brought to the table that was not a Paul Kelly song for that project was Every Time We Say Goodbye. And the reason why I did it was because, and this is no slight on Paul, don't get this the wrong way, but you don't have to be a brilliant singer to sing Every Time We Say Goodbye.
And the other thing too is...
a lot of it's on one note.
But also the other thing too is you're selling lyrics as much as you're singing the song.
That's the thing. You see, he loves the lyrics. Yeah. They're right up his alley. So
just picking up that, I hope you don't mind me saying this, but what you've just described there is an incredible willingness to allow other things to fill spaces, a kind of a patience, a willingness to sort of almost play whilst you're a collaborator, not be the predominant player in that space. If I remember you when you were just starting out, there was, and it's like we all were, there was a desire in every song or every performance that this is the last thing I'm going to do, so I have to display everything in every moment.
That's right.
And so, you know, I guess if I'm an observer of your career and your performance, you've become much more mellow and much more willing to allow the space to be filled over the longer duration.
You know, that's a lovely thing to hear. I do think, I look at my sort of trajectory as being a kind of reductive process in a way.
Soon you'll be just doing that. Hovering.
Well, you know, for people, and obviously there was somebody who was there last night asking about the Duduk. I don't know whether it was because the act of playing itself is such an emotional thing at the moment because we have been kept away from it. But there was, I felt that the band reached, and you know, that band, Torio, which is a trio with myself, Mirko Guerini on various wind instruments, and Nico Schäuble. And Nico and I have been playing together for many, many years. In fact, Nico was the drummer on our Tonight Show for a while.
Yeah.
But, you know, Nico and I have got an almost, you know, we laugh about it, but it's an almost astral communication that we have when we play. We're able to play things which you couldn't possibly sort of discuss or notate, and they happen simultaneously, and it happens quite a lot. So we're sort of inside each other's heads musically. But last night, I think we were reaching these sort of moments of stillness, and the kind of happy place that we were was pianissimo, which is very unusual in jazz. I mean, jazz is more often than not quite loud music, not as loud as rock and roll, but it, nevertheless, you know, and pianists often have to play really heavily into the piano in order to project above all the sort of noise which is happening around them, which means that for a lot of pianists, they end up losing the subtleties of touch if they're not careful. Because it is possible as a pianist to play very, you know, to really project and play a good forte at the piano without bashing into the keys.
It's true what you say. Most people's version of a band or a unit that's humming is where, you know, when they're in that moment, is when they're really pumping, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's when, but most people's version of an outfit that's going is when they're really pumping along, which means everyone's bashing it out along.
If you listen to a really great pianist like Keith Jarrett, for example, or Herbie Hancock's another one, Brad Meldow, they can play incredibly intensely, and you know, and the band are kind of really going hard. But it's never an ugly sound which is being made.
No.
Because of the way that Keith, you know, or any of those pianists use their whole body to play into the key. They're not trying to bash as if they're trying to play an old typewriter.
Have you ever made noises while you play?
Oh, I do the whole time.
I mean, noises coming out your mouth as opposed, as opposed to other orifices. But do you ever... Are you a...
I'm a grunter, yes.
Are you?
Yeah.
When?
Oh, the whole time I'm playing. It's completely unconscious. But you know,
you're not as bad as Keith.
No, Keith is takes it to the next level.
Yeah.
And you know, but he says about that it's part of the ecstasis.
Yeah.
You know that it's a spontaneous thing that happens. I mean, it can be very annoying listening to it on recordings. I used to find it almost unbearable. These days, of course, you know, the great tragedy is Keith can't actually play anymore, which is incomprehensible to me. But I would forgive him anything now. But, you know, one of the things which you can never, ever take away from Keith Jarrett is the extraordinary sound he makes at the instrument. There is no pianist like him.
Sublime, isn't it?
It's absolutely extraordinary.
Has anyone, we're just rambling on, but has anyone got any questions that they want to ask of Paul? Anything?
I've got a question. So you and Paul have written some operas together, and I'd be really interested if you remember any of the pieces from it, and maybe hear a little bit about that process,
you know,
writing the music.
Gosh, I don't know that I'd be able to drag up a song from Banquet of Secrets.
I pretty much carried the whole thing anyway, so so we wrote...
actually write any music?
It's Paul, isn't it? We've written a few things together, but we wrote most recently a piece for Emma Matthews, wonderful opera singer, one woman... what would you call it?
I'd call her a woman for a start.
Yeah, she's definitely a
you're
woman.
You're on the right track there.
Yeah, beautiful piece, partially about her own upbringing, her life. But before that, we wrote an opera. It was only for five people, and it was called Banquet of Secrets. And in a nutshell, I'll just tell you briefly what it was about. It's because it was based on our own experience.
Back around 1 o'clock.
Yeah, would you mind?
Yeah.
So Paul and I were at uni together with some other guys, and this was the premise of the opera was about a group of friends who would meet. We meet more frequently than this, but they meet once a year every year at the same cafe that they were at when they were at uni, and every year they have a catch-up. And they have a meal like they've always had. So this particular year, they're sort of our age now, and they've been doing this every year. This particular year, the friends meet, and they decide that... One of them asks a question, is it possible that friends as old as us could have secrets from each other? Because we've known each other our whole lives. So they challenge each other over the course of the meal. As each course is brought out, one of them will tell a secret that they've never told anyone else over this meal. The opera's called Banquet of Secrets. So each of these four friends, and then there's a waiter as well, divulges a secret. And the final secret that one of them divulges is that this is going to be his last meal, that he's actually dying. And so it's a comedy. And so Paul... but it was sort of, it's based on our friendship.
That last high kick routine in the mall
is
one of my favourites.
It's fantastic, isn't it? So Paul wrote some beautiful, each person's secret has a beautiful aria, really, isn't it? And one of them is he's going to walk the...
The Camino. Yeah.
The Camino. His wife died and he's going to walk the Camino. You wrote a beautiful song for that. I don't think you'd remember it, though, would you?
No. I haven't played it for ages, and you know, I don't even remember Banquet of Secrets. Did we write that?
Yeah, we did. Yeah. And it was a beautiful performance. But so I'm filling in here, but as to how we did it, I wrote 70% of the lyrics first, and you wrote the music after, and then I'd modify it based on you having completely got all of the meters wrong.
Turn his mic off.
And then the other ones, you wrote some really beautiful melodies, and I'd write
very kind of you.
The lyrics based on those, so
which were not so beautiful as it turned out.
But yeah, we had a stellar cast.
No, it was wonderful. It was. I must say, I loved writing that, and it's a beautiful story. And I was saying to Steve yesterday, actually, that I hope it gets another airing because it's. You know, audiences loved it. It's a funny thing because, you know, both of us really love musical theatre and the idea of writing opera, it's a bit of a stretch. I mean, I've written opera before. I wrote an opera with Joanna Murray-Smith 20 years ago, nearly, called Love in the Age of Therapy, which was a comic opera. And that, again, had some of the same people in the cast. But you know, I feel that what we arrived at with Banquet of Secrets was somewhere in between music theatre and opera. Probably closer in spirit, in a way, to Sondheim, I think, you know, who we both adore. And, you know, I tried to have something of an element of that about it in the music. You know, and obviously my love of jazz inflects everything that I write to a greater or lesser degree, so that's all in there too.
So there's, but thank you for the question. Anyone else got any questions, observations? Would they like to insult either of us or anything at all?
Oh, look, their hand went up.
Just ask away.
Sondheim tragically died, obviously, very recently. Yeah.
No, I never met him, I'm sorry I didn't. I remember, and I think, did you attend the workshop that he gave out here? I unfortunately didn't know about it, and when was that, about, what, 20 years ago?
He did a couple, but one of them was at the time of when they did A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum.
Right.
He was out again, but he'd done one previously as well.
Yeah. Well, you know, what I love about Sondheim is his songs are so unique. He's got a really incredible musical language. And it's not that kind of Broadway-sounding musical language that you associate with the earlier generation. The Rodgers and Hammerstein, Jerome Kern, you know, Jules Stein kind of music, which is much more rooted in a more conventional harmony of, you know, what we call dominant voice leading, a circle of fifths kind of music. There's something more abstract and modal about Sondheim's music, and it gives it a particular sense of poignancy. And also, he's got this really fantastic sense of rhythm. Because he writes the lyrics and is probably imagining the lyrics working in lockstep with the music from the beginning, they have this amazing kind of power. The music and the words lift each other up. So there's never a dull moment in Sondheim. It's always 100% on.
He says this most amazing thing, just from a lyricist's point of view, about, and he's really the person who explains it best when asked, you know, what is it about writing lyrics that's different from poetry or other things? He says, they're fundamentally different because, unlike a poem where you can stop and start and reread a line and take your own time, basically the reader's in control, in music theatre, which is the same as opera, the tempo of the music is unstoppable. Whatever that tempo is, the music keeps going. And so the lyrics have to make sense on first hearing with the music at that time as a once pass. You don't get a second chance. There's no chance to stop and have a breather or re-examine. That's the pace it happens at. So you can't overwrite, you can't be too complex. And that's why the unison of his music and the lyrics is so fundamentally perfect, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Any observations? Do you want to? We must be getting close to it is. Do you want to play a song?
I'll play that song.
And then we'll call it quits and you can go and escape.
My leg has gone to sleep. Interesting.
So what are we hearing?
I'm going to play Every Time We Say Goodbye.
Right.
I think.
Nice. Thank you.
Paul Grabowski. Give him a round of applause. Thanks
Steve
for coming.
Isaac.
Thanks for coming,
Thanks
folks.
For coming, folks.
Have a great day. See you later.
That was Paul Grabowski in conversation with Steve Izard at Melbourne International Jazz Festival Congress 2021. Please keep in touch with Melbourne International Jazz Festival by subscribing to our e-news at melbournejazz.com. Follow us on social media and subscribe on your preferred platform for more podcast episodes. We would like to thank Principal Partners Creative Victoria and the Australia Council, the Vizard Foundation, the Rise Fund, an Australian Government Initiative, the Helen McPherson Smith Trust, and the US Consulate.